nailed about contraception and abortion going back to the early Christian era, right? Mm-hmm. To the third and the fourth and the fifth centuries of the Common Era, and moving forwards into the medieval times, but going really back to those early Christian days when some of the Christian fathers spoke out quite openly about the right of women and the necessity of women to be able to control their own fertility and to have abortions. Mm-hmm. Although the positions were very complicated, complex, and there were different perspectives about women who were from lower realms of life, prostitution, but also women of higher stature and rank. And there were all sorts of methods of contraception being used and abortion, and even I've read about late-term abortion was commonly accepted. Could you talk a little bit about this history going back? What kinds of contraceptive measures did women use back in the 5th and 6th century Common Era and into the medieval times and the Renaissance? It's a lot of history.
There is a lot of history, and my expertise is really more on the 19th and 20th century United States, but I do know some of the kinds of things that they would do, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. So we're looking at things like using astringent douching mechanisms after sex. I mean, that's a very old method that carries right up through the 20th century. They had pessaries that they would insert. Often they would, make some kind of powdered tablet that they would insert into the vagina that presumably was supposed to prevent pregnancy, or either right just before or right after intercourse. There are a variety of herbs and plants that were known to bring on abortion, such as tansy, rue, savin, black cohosh. And some of these plants are more native to the Americas. And so Native Americans here in what is now North America would have had a long history and understanding of knowing what kinds of plants or herbs to use. But in Europe, they had similar kind of lore about what herbs and plants you could grow in the garden to bring on the menses. Because a lot of times women who had not gotten a period might not even understand themselves to be pregnant. They instead were focusing on the idea that, my period hasn't started. Something must be wrong. But it wasn't necessarily pregnancy, because of the humoral theory of medicine, which was the idea that blood, bile, mucus, all of these bodily fluids within us had to be in balance. And if when you got sick, it was because they were out of balance. I mean, this is a very old idea. It dates from the ancient Greeks. But in the medieval, early modern period, and really up until, I would argue, the end of the 19th century, even in the United States, there was the idea that you had to start your period through one of these methods, whether it was drinking a special tea or taking a pill that made out of these herbal concoctions. And of course, these things were not super safe because nothing was regulated. If you took too much of these things, you could die. You could get poisoning. but that is not to say that women didn't use these things and really understood the idea that pregnancy was not something that was really real to them until they could feel the baby move. And so there are surgical abortion, in the past, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, I'm sure we have accounts of that. I can't imagine that it was very safe in the past before, antiseptics. but by the middle of the 19th century, as medicine does start to advance just a little bit, surgical abortion did gain some popularity, especially in the United States. And so, but the vast majority of abortion probably was chemically induced, medically induced, not surgical. And really that's a parallel to today, because the vast majority of abortion in the United States now are from medication abortion, from mifepristone and misoprostol, the protocol that's under attack right now from the Texas court, district court. And so that's something that is kind of in common. It's been, you know, the vast majority of abortions take place in the first trimester. But of course, as surgical techniques have advanced, abortion now, surgical abortion is very, very safe. It's safer than a 9-month pregnancy and labor and delivery.
And so in the 17th and 18th century in America, the 18th century, abortion was legal under common law.
Yes, it was. There were no laws about abortion at all. And the idea was that if they could prove infanticide, that was something different. But often the line between miscarriage, abortion, and infanticide was pretty blurred. And so often what you find in these early court cases dealing with abortion is that they're being punished under adultery laws or like laws about not having sex outside of marriage or and so that they're not really concerned necessarily about the abortion. It's more just like that's a result of something sinful that they did. So they're more concerned about the immorality of the sex than they are the immorality of the abortion itself. And we see that repeatedly in early court cases. And of course, by the time you get to the 19th century, we do begin to see prosecutions based on state abortion laws. But for most of them, they're often going after the person performing the abortion, less so than the woman who was seeking to have an abortion.
And prior to the 19th century, was it the view that women had the right to control their own bodies?
Yeah, there was really kind of a sense, I think, in the 18th century, especially in the colonial United States, that, you know, women had an essential right to the integrity of their own body. I mean, it was not something that I think men really thought about. That was women's work. That was women's job. I mean, you gave birth at home with a midwife. I mean, the midwife would perform an abortion for you if you needed it or help address a miscarriage, that kind of thing. And so I think that the absence of, you know, one of Justice Alito's tenets in the opinion to argue to return abortion to the states is he said something like, you know, since it wasn't in the Constitution, clearly they didn't want to make it legal. But that doesn't, the absence of a mention of abortion in the Constitution doesn't really mean much, because I think it was something that they just considered a part of everyday life. And unless you were a person who performed an abortion and ended up killing the woman, I mean, that was something different, right? That could be prosecuted as murder. But if you performed successful abortions, you know, in the second trimester, even late term abortions, I don't know how common those were, but I'm sure they happened. If the woman lived and went on to live her life, you know, nothing might happen to you legally.
So what happened in the 20th century? Or should I say in the 19th century, and focus on let's cut to the chase here, the Comstock Act of 1873. What was that all about? Tell us about the Comstock Act and what impact it had on women's right to terminate pregnancies.
Yeah, so by the time that Anthony Comstock, who's a vice reformer from New York, he is very concerned about prostitution and pornography and sexual material and the red light districts in New York. And he is working alongside the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA, to kind of clean up the streets of New York. He raids brothels, he raids bars, he raids bookshops that are selling, you know, dirty material, that kind of thing. So, but he ends up going to Washington, D.C. with trunkfuls of confiscated items that he then puts on display for the senators and representatives in Congress, and they set up some kind of exhibit like in the vice president's office in Congress. And of course, the congressmen go by and kind of gawk at things. And, you know, in the winter of 1873, they draft this bill in committee, and it gets pretty quickly sent out to the floor and passed. And, you know, and then it goes on to the House of Representatives, where it's passed with even less discussion. And the congressional record indicates that, you know, there was actually a few senators asking, wait a minute, what are we voting for? What is this? And there's the sense that, like, it's kind of chaotic. It's late at night. They don't know, like, they're like, oh, fine, just pass it, you know. And one senator says, I hope we're not going to regret this, or something to that effect. But then the law had a lot of teeth. You know, I think that that senator was very prescient, because the law, the 1873 Comstock law, it layered on top of a whole set of state abortion laws. It layers another set of legal ramifications on abortion. It classifies anything having to do with abortion or birth control as obscenity, alongside pornography, sexual material, that kind of thing.
And what was the underlying rationale? What was it obscene about it? Was it that it was unchristian or immoral, or that, you know, the unborn had a right to life? Or was it, was there something more associated with this idea, getting back to Samuel Alito conjuring this up about the supply of babies, the supply of white babies?
Yes, I think almost all of those things. I have not seen anything where Comstock in particular is really talking about a fetal right to life. I haven't seen him voice anything really like that, but in other interviews I've seen him, you know, or in writings that he produced at the time, he talks about how all of anything having to do with sex, you know, outside of marriage or beyond procreative sex is immoral. And so there's this, the push to establish what obscenity was in the late 19th century is really big. It's it comes out of a Protestant element that is very strong in American history, obviously dating back to the Puritans. And it's a reaction to a lot of the social transformations that are taking place in that period. I mean, this is post-Civil War, post-emancipation. It's the height of, you know, as suffrage really starts to ramp up and women are appearing in the public sphere, they're attending college, they're attending graduate school. And there's a lot of social change and transformation happening. And I think that people like Comstock were sort of desperate to reestablish some kind of moral order. And so that was really the impetus for the Comstock laws. But what it does is it creates this federal set of punishments layered on top of state punishments. So somebody who was seeking an abortion could be then prosecuted not under only state laws, but also federal law. And the federal law had a lot of teeth. It had steep fines, jail time. There were there was a virtual army of postal inspectors that were appointed to this special office in the post office that they were responsible for searching through people's mails to see if they were mailing anything obscene or indecent.
Searching for pennyroyal.
Mm-hmm. So it could be anything from mailing abortifacients to someone to mailing a pornographic magazine. Like, I mean, it was sort of all treated the same.
And where did fear of immigration fit in here? Because late 19th century waves of immigrants coming to the United States. So where did that fit in?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we're seeing a shift in the kind of groups of immigrants that are coming over to the U.S. in this period. You know, in the 1830s, 1840s, it's mostly Irish, German, Northern European. And then we get this shift to not only Southern and Eastern European immigrants, but also Asian immigrants, particularly, you know, Chinese laborers who are coming over to work in the West on the railroad. And so America is really rapidly transforming. There's a lot of physical movement, you know, happening. And I think that this is also the period where eugenics begins its ascent in American thought. It was an incredibly popular and deeply respected science. I mean, we tend to think of eugenics as junk science. It's bad science. That's what Nazis do. But eugenics was embedded in every aspect of American life. Practically, you could see advertising for eugenic hats or eugenic shampoo, you know, if you open up late 19th century, early 20th century newspapers. So there's this idea. It all does kind of go back to the idea that the white race needs to figure out or white native born Protestant race, you know, needs to figure out the best way to maintain supremacy.
And people were talking about race suicide.
Yes. So that could mean different things. It could just mean sort of like the survival of the general human race, but it also took on a racial element, depending on who was saying it and who was using it. This is also the period of American imperialism. You know, by the 1890s, we're making forays into places like the Philippines and Puerto Rico. And so all of these things are kind of converging together. And Comstock lives to see all of this because he doesn't die until 1915. But after his death, that's when we begin to see sort of a rapid shift in how American courts start to treat obscenity. And there begins to be this kind of backlash against the obscenity regime that stretched over the United States for decades and decades. And you get famous court cases that start to chip away at those obscenity laws and in favor of a more free speech and free expression, you know, so the expansion of civil liberties. So there's sort of this tension between what's happening there and then also World War One and the restriction of speech in the United States, you know, to enforce patriotism for the war, the Red Scare, you know, those kinds of things are happening. But then there's this whole push to expand freedom of expression at the same time. So that's America for you, though. Always lots of competing things happening at the same time.
Throughout all this period that we're talking about, it became harder for women to obtain contraceptives or to have abortions carried out. I don't want to say safe abortions because I'm sure a lot of them weren't safe at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag. I certainly think that the Comstock Act, combined with those state level anti-contraceptive and anti-abortion laws, they certainly had a chilling effect. It was very shameful. You know, people who did seek abortion, you know, knew, oh, you know, I could get in big trouble for this. People who performed abortions, same thing. But at the same time, the proliferation of advertising in newspapers and magazines for contraceptives and abortive fashions is really mind-boggling. You open up any late 19th century newspaper and you're going to see advertisements for pennyroyal pills, you know, female doctoresses, you know, who are open for business on the corner, you know, like they advertise these things in newspapers because you know, it was, again, a common feature of life. And people, no matter what, are going to attempt to restrict their fertility, no matter the laws that are in place. And there was a whole commercial market ready to take that on. And we begin to see court cases in the early 20th century that, you know, the Comstock Act targets these advertisers. They target the manufacturers of these medicines, these patent medicines, but they're starting to win in court. And that's because the courts are saying, well, actually, some of this stuff has medicinal use. So there's, like, if they prosecute a condom manufacturer, for example, in the World War One era, a court is going to say, well, condoms are necessary to prevent the spread of disease. And so therefore, the advertising and manufacture of these of this product is not obscene. It is for a medical use.
Where does the emergence of professionalized obstetrics and gynecology fit in within the medical profession? The medical profession is becoming more professional, and you're getting professionalized obstetrics and gynecology, and you get men, sort of men providing women with health care and health services rather than women providing women with those services themselves. Mm-hmm. How does this figure in?
Yeah, that's a big transition, as you said, that takes place over the course of the 19th century. So women, the vast majority of births by about 1920 are taking place in the hospital. Obstetrics and gynecology is a very respected profession. And so you do have physicians, though, by the 1920s who are coming out and openly saying that birth control is part of public health. It's part of medical practice. They're not making the same arguments about abortion, but that's because most of the people who supported legalized contraception had this very firm idea that if birth control was just legal for everyone, then abortions really won't be necessary. I mean, maybe occasionally for a medical reason, but other than that, nobody will be needing an abortion as a remedy for a pregnancy that they don't want. And instead, everyone can just prevent the pregnancy in the first place. And so you do get very prominent physicians who begin to, you know, represent organizations like the American Birth Control League. You know, they have a medical director who goes around and gives talks to hospitals and public health organizations and even the general public and says, you know, this is why contraception is important. So by the middle to late 1930s, you know, and I would say into the 1940s, you really have a lot of physicians who are very much on board with birth control, who prescribe it to their patients. There are birth control clinics that open where patients who can't necessarily afford private medical care, they can go and get fitted for a diaphragm or a pessary. And so there are very much expanding clinical opportunities to obtain birth control. Now, that being said, I think that we start to really see illegal abortion kind of, even as contraception is becoming more widely available, the stigma around abortion remains, and you continue to have a lot of women who end up in the hospital because of septic abortions, abortions that have gone wrong, self-induced abortions, right? Because there's still, like, even as, you know, contraception is becoming more accepted, it's still stigmatized. It's still something that is taboo somewhat to talk about. And so by the 1950s, you've just got a very high rate of illegal abortions. You have whole wards and hospitals that are specifically devoted to treating women who have gone septic or who are hemorrhaging after a botched abortion. And by the middle of the 60s, I mean, that's really when a lot of, you know, the stories that kind of galvanized the American public to really to rally around support for abortion rights. I mean, people are outraged at seeing photographs of women lying in pools of blood in hotel rooms and things like that. And that really kind of puts the issue forefront, and people begin to realize, you know, both of these things have to be legal in order to have appropriate reproductive health care as a public health measure.
And the birth control movement in the, I guess, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, this is a quote from yourself, became yet another catalyst in expanding and solidifying racist and paternalist decision-making in American medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, nothing is ever just one simple story, right? So yes, expanding birth control access, but at the same time, physicians who are supporting birth control often have very eugenic ideas about who should use it, right? So it does fit into the sterilization movement. You know, lots and lots of poor white women, for example, in the Midwest being sterilized, and poor black women in states like North Carolina or Alabama being sterilized, certainly Latino women in places like California, Native American women living on reservations. There's a push by a lot of white American medicine to ensure that, again, only the right kind of people are having babies. And so there's forced contraception, forced sterilization that takes place that's legal under the 14th Amendment. You know, Buck v. Bell, the case in 1928, says that three generations of imbeciles is enough. You know, Judge Oliver Wendell Holmes says, you know, in the interest of, like, saving the race and creating a fit, you know, having the most fit race, right, we can sterilize people who should not be having children. And so birth control has always been a huge legal and social paradox, because it represents freedom, it represents self-determination, it represents feminism, it represents all of those things. But on the other hand, in our history, it also represents the racist schisms, the paternalistic kind of regime that America existed and it continues to exist under. So it means many things at the same time, and that's why this question is so complicated.
And Justice Blackmun's majority opinion in Roe versus Wade refutes that abortion is a woman's absolute right. It's not an absolute right that women have. It's the domain of medicine.
Yes. Yeah. So there's this push to link contraception and abortion with medicine. And on the one hand, that is good because it makes things safer. It makes things more regulated. That's not a bad thing. But as we have seen over the last, you know, eight decades in our country, you know, the fact that, you know, even as it became part of medicine, it also became siloed away from regular medicine. So by like in the post-Roe era, that's why you have abortion clinics instead of like your regular OBGYN just performing it in the office. You know, there's this push to bring this stuff in within medicine so that they can control it. And then there's a kind of a siloing of it over the last 30, 40 years. And that's, I think, explains a lot about how we have ended up where we have ended up today, because mainstream physicians are not the ones performing abortions. It was never normalized within medical training after Roe. And so there's all kinds of things going on here.
Lauren Thompson, last question. What's at stake in the abortion rights debate, in your view? Is it just the struggle for reproductive rights for women? Or is there more at stake in this for all people, for men and women?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would say that reproductive justice is a nice, big, inclusive circle that includes everybody. It includes not just the right to obtain contraception or abortion, but also the right to have children, to have babies, to determine your future and how many children you want, whether that's none or whether that's 10, right? And so I think that what's at stake here is the, you know, how far are we going to let the Constitution either restrict or grant these kinds of rights? I mean, should they be at stake at all as a legal question? And so I think it's bringing up all kinds of constitutional questions. It's bringing up questions about women's role in society, but it's also kind of exposing the need for self-determination for everybody. And in a free society, in a democracy, which we purport to be a constitutional democracy, or republic, you know, the question of being able to determine your future the way that you want is really crucial to the individual. And so I think it just remains to be seen how our politics are going to treat this issue going forward. I mean, it certainly seems like we're in a phase where we're leaning toward restricting these kinds of things, right? And so I think we're going to continue to see this tension and this push-pull in the next couple of decades.
Lauren McIver-Thompson is an assistant professor of history at Kennesaw State University in Kennesaw, Georgia, and a historian of early 20th century women's rights and public health at Georgia State University College of Law's Center for Law, Health, and Society. We'll link to several of Lauren Thompson's scholarly and media pieces about women's reproductive rights at greenplanetmonitor.net. It for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is a fellow named Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Hello, this is Boris Hassan. To get a feel on what's happening across the country, listen to Viewpoints. For reports, interviews, and documentaries on politics, arts and culture, the environment, housing, and more. Thanks to 30 journalists stationed in the Canadian provinces and territories. Local news nationwide. Mondays at 4:30 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM and streaming online at cjsf.ca.